Message to Israel. Shalom Aleichem. Peace be unto you. Shema Yisrael Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. This is the voice of the message to Israel. Multitudes in many eras have found that the Hebrew Psalms expressed their own perplexities and aspirations, their thanksgivings and their pleas. Psalm 2 is no exception. Portraying man's revolt on earth and God's reaction in heaven, it contains both a warning and a great reassurance. God will not be shaken by the rebellion of man. He will proceed with his plans, and he wants us to enter into them. In his series of meditations on the Psalms, our Message to Israel voice, A.J. Overton, proceeds from the perfect man of Psalm 1 to the glorious king of Psalm 2, Mr. Overton.
Thank you, and greetings, friends, in the name of the Lord Yeshua. We continue our meditations on the Psalms. Today, Psalm 2. The Psalms possess a great history. They were composed over a lengthy period from approximately 1400 to 400 B.C. King David, Isaiah, and Jeremiah, and all the prophets have been joined by multitudes from many eras to give expression through the Psalms to their thanksgivings and perplexities, their aspirations and pleas. The very Lord of the psalmists and David's greater son, Yeshua HaMashiach, Jesus Christ, sang the Psalms on the night before he suffered, cried out their agonies on the cross, and rejoiced in his resurrection to behold both their fulfilled and anticipated prophecies. He declared on that resurrection day, "All things must be fulfilled which were written in the law of Moses and in the prophets and in the Psalms concerning me." Then opened he their understanding, that they might understand the Scriptures, and said unto them, "Thus it is written, and thus it behooved Christ, Messiah, to suffer and rise from the dead the third day." The first two Psalms are linked together in the Hebrew Scriptures to form a fitting introduction and preface to the Psalter as a whole. Psalm 1 speaks of the two ways of man, the righteous and the ungodly, measured by relation to God's law. Psalm 2 speaks of the two ways, involving nations as well as individuals, measured by relation to God's anointed one, the Messiah, his Son. The perfect man and the glorious king thus form the theme of the first and second Psalms. The second Psalm is in the nature of a prophecy. It is messianic. This magnificent lyric is in four stanzas of three verses each. Stanza 1, verses 1 through 3, pictures the revolt and confederacy against Jehovah and his anointed one. "Why do the nations rage and the peoples imagine a vain thing? The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, Let us break their bands asunder and cast away their cords from us." Here we find the counsel of God concerning his anointed rejected by the inhabitants of the earth, though owned in heaven. The psalm's structure is dramatic. The voice of the psalmist asks the question, "Why?" This inquiry includes both astonishment and the thought of the utter futility of such senseless rejection of God's rule and his ruler. Nations rage, tumultuously assemble, seething in antagonism. They literally meditate a vain plan. The same verb states that the godly man meditates upon God's law. The discontent becomes the resolved conspiracy. However, it is vain, devised futility, indicating that it will all fail. Nations, peoples, kings, and dignitaries form a beehive of unholy determination against the Lord and against his anointed, Messiah or Christ. God's name used here speaks of grace and faithfulness. Never were men more wrong than to oppose him who alone offers salvation. and this activity was directed against the Anointed One, God's King. The immediate earthly king, the author of this psalm, the Anointed One, is David himself. The nations understood that an unusual dignity was claimed for Israel's king. But the description is too great to have its meaning exhausted by David, Solomon, or any other Jewish monarch. It typifies much greater. A partial fulfillment of this prophecy took place at Messiah's first advent. The book of Acts chapter 4, 25 through 28 states, "Who with the mouth of thy servant David has said, Why did the nations rage and the people imagine vain things? The kings of the earth stood up and the rulers were gathered together against the Lord and against his Christ. For of a truth against thy holy child Jesus, whom thou hast anointed, both Herod and Pontius Pilate with the Gentiles and the people of Israel were gathered together to do whatever thy hand and thy counsel determined before to be done." However, the fact that Jehovah's anointed was thus at his coming put to death in God's determinate counsel has not exhausted this prophecy. The age in which we live continues its rejection. Nations and councils continue to imagine vain things and oppose God and his anointed. There is yet to be the final fulfillment of the opening verses of this psalm. From this picture of the revolt and confederacy against Jehovah and his anointed one, we come now to stanza 2, verses 4 through 6, that presents the reaction and intervention of the heavens. "He that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh. The Lord shall have them in derision. Then shall he speak to them in his wrath and vex them in his sore displeasure. Yet have I set my king upon my holy hill of Zion." The rhythm of the Hebrew text changes here to become full and thunder-like. There is one sitting upon heaven's eternal throne that cannot be shaken. Upon the Father's right hand sits the one who was the perfect servant on earth and whose cross bore the title of king. Heaven will not always keep its silence. First, there is laughter in heaven, an indication of the utter impossibility of thwarting God's purposes. Pharaoh's command to drown the newly born sons of Israel did not destroy Israel's name from the earth. It resulted in Moses, Israel's deliverer, receiving a princely education by Pharaoh's daughter in his own court. Did not God laugh? But after laughter must come judgment. God derides, and then he speaks in his wrath. Not since the flood of Noah has the Lord spoken in such wrath to the human race. But one day he will speak again in judgment. In this dramatic poem, the voice of God the Father gives reply to the rebellious nations. "Yet have I set my king upon my holy hill of Zion. Let rulers rage and peoples imagine a vain thing. But in his own good time, God will fulfill his promise and give to his son the throne of his father David, from which he will reign over the house of Jacob forever, and of his kingdom there will be no end. Thus is the determination of Jehovah God." The third stanza, verses 7 through 9, now brings before us the response of the king, his decree and dominion. "I will make known the decree. Jehovah hath said unto me, My son thou art, I have this day begotten thee. Ask of me, and I will give thee nations for thine inheritance, and for thy possession the ends of the earth. Thou shalt break them with a rod of iron. As a potter's vessel shalt thou break them to fragments." The basis of this decree, "Thou art my son, this day have I begotten thee," is the prophecy of Nathan to David, which sets forth the dignity and dominion of the king of Israel as God's son and representative. The picture here is actual and ideal. Beyond David, his throne and rule are greater things to come. This grand poem idealizes the king of Israel, but with expected realization. Three times the Spirit of God applies this to Jesus Christ the Messiah in the New Testament or covenant. In Acts 13, he is so addressed in his incarnation and resurrection. God hath fulfilled the same, in that he raised up Jesus again, as it is written, Thou art my Son, this day have I begotten thee, as concerning that he raised him from the dead. The book of Hebrews twice applies this psalm to Jesus Christ in resurrection and exaltation. At Messiah's second return, he will ask and receive the ends of the earth for his possession. His rod is the rod of iron over all opposing forces in that day. The fourth stanza, verses 10 through 12, gives a wise recommendation to the nations. And now be wise, ye kings. Be instructed, ye judges of the earth. Serve Jehovah with fear, rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry, and ye perish in the way, for soon his wrath will be kindled. Blessed are all that trust in him. Thus this great dramatic poetic prophecy ends with a call to acknowledge him. This has special meaning while mercy still lingers. The warning as a whole will not be heeded by the rebellious. But when he returns and is enthroned, every knee must bow. How joyful for those who trust him now. Will you do so?
And now may the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob cause his face to shine upon you and be gracious unto you and give you peace. Shalom.